start tonight. Glad that you're all with us for sure. Looking forward to studying these, hopefully, these two chapters together this evening. We're in Genesis chapter 20 to start out with. So go ahead and be opening up to Genesis 20. And we'll begin there, continuing a study of the life of Abraham. Getting back this week to actually looking more at Abraham. We took that bit of a break in last week's study because the events of Sodom and Gomorrah were so central to the story. Still has a lot to do with Abraham, obviously, but we're getting back kind of onto the ground level with him and his family here in Genesis chapter 20. Before we start there, let's begin with a word of prayer. Please join me in bowing to our Father. Holy God, we give you thanks for this day and all of its many blessings. We see the beauty of the day and the world that you have made around us, and we are in awe of your power that you could create such wonders. In fact, that you did so merely by speaking words. We're thankful that you have wielded your power in a way that is so beneficial to us, that you have desired to save us from that which we could not save ourselves from. We're grateful for your Son and his sacrifice on our behalf, the salvation that we have through him, the inheritance that we have as your children. We are truly thankful for all the blessings you have given to us and will continue to give. As we study tonight, we ask that you would be with us and help us to see always more clearly who you are as you have described yourself, that we would be impressed with those who have come before us, their faith, even after times where they have fallen, the confidence that they had in you. We pray that we would be strengthened to see your faithfulness to keep your word, even when you have made such great promises. We're thankful for these words that we look at tonight that will help us to see you more clearly and glorify you through our study of them. Be with us tonight is our prayer in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Well, we're here in Genesis chapter 20. That background that I'm using tonight is those are Philistines from some Egyptian carvings. The Egyptians have quite a bit of run-ins with the Philistines even before, well, before there was an Israel, I guess, and before the Israelites did. But we're getting into chapter 20, into some dealings with Philistines and events that take place in what is described, even at the time, as the lands of the Philistines. They are not really a big deal in Scripture until quite a bit later, really kind of later into the book of Judges. They'll really take on a more important role, and then all throughout the life of David, especially among the kings. But just interesting that we find them here this early. There's a lot we don't know about the Philistines. Obviously, we're not going to go into them very much tonight. I think it's kind of fun to encounter them so early on in the story. But we don't know a lot about them, where they originally came from, and how they got to Palestine, which is a word that comes from Philistines. That's what the title that the Romans gave that area, in fact, as I understand it. But a lot of thought that they came maybe from Greece or maybe from Crete, that they were kind of part of the sea peoples, that civilization that was all around the Mediterranean at the time. But they, like Israel, were kind of pilgrims who had come to that area of the world. It seems they were not original inhabitants. But we find at least a group of them operating here in chapter 20 and 21. I also mention that as far as it pertains to our story, just to mention, we meet a man in chapter 20 and 21 named Abimelech, and there will also be an Abimelech that we encounter in chapter 26 who has a very, very similar interaction with Isaac as to what happens here with Abraham. That name is a name that we encounter several times throughout the Old Testament, and it seems there's pretty good evidence to think that it might be some kind of title that was given to Philistine kings. In the same way that when you read about the king of Egypt in Scripture, he's often just called Pharaoh, as if it's his name. It'll just refer to, you know, he said this to Pharaoh, and we understand that's the title given to their ruler. That's the title given to their monarch. We might be able to think of Abimelech functioning in kind of the same way among the Philistine rulers, or at least this group of them here. So in chapter 26, probably a different man, I would say. And then, you know, King David will meet an Abimelech among the Philistines, who is a chief or a kind of king ruler of their people. So just something to keep our eyes on. But that is how this story starts, an interaction that Abraham has with a man named Abimelech as he is once again going on his travels. In verse 1, it begins by telling us about Abraham journeying, making these journeys to the south of the Negev. We've talked about that before, is not just a direction on the compass, but being kind of a region that he's going to. In that area, kind of going from Israel towards Egypt is where that Negev traditionally is. But there's no reason given for the journey here. It sounds like this is just part of that wandering that he engaged in. And he mentions that even later in this account, that that is what God assigned him as his lot, really, that he would wander on the earth, and that's what he's been doing. He hasn't had a permanent home. And so it seems that that is just how he is traveling around at this time. Now, I mentioned one of the questions that I had asked as we look at this. This story in chapter 20 is very similar to what we saw in chapter 12, isn't it? Where Abraham is there traveling through Egypt, and it's this same kind of setup. He's going to say that Sarah is his sister, not his wife, and someone really kind of because of that thinks she's available. I can do something with her. I can make her my wife, and that ends up causing a kind of problem when this man gets himself into something that he doesn't fully understand. What differences do we see between these two accounts? We're able to kind of think. Oftentimes, there is meaning to be found in the differences that these the different turns these stories take. So, chapter 20 versus chapter 12. How do we see them changing the formula a little bit, Brother Garen? Yeah. Yeah, it is really interesting. You know, we think of these faithful people, these kind of heroic characters. They're going to do everything right all the time. Certainly, when they do make a mistake, they'll learn from it, right? They won't do the same thing twice. But that's not how humans function. A lot of times, we do make the same mistakes over and over again. And really, a lot of the lessons that we mentioned in that first instance are still going to have to apply here because it's much the same thing happening again. So, yeah, Tim. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we came out ahead pretty well in the first time. Maybe a key difference there. Tim mentioned, if you couldn't hear him, the idea with Pharaoh in Genesis chapter 12, how does God show him or tell him kind of that this is bad, that this, I don't like what you're doing? They've got an affliction. There's some kind of plague going on. I mean, there's hardship that they're facing here, although maybe there's an idea later on of there was some kind of physical affliction among the people, and especially maybe among the women. But God actually speaks to Abimelech in much the same way he will to Abraham, in much the same way that he will to these people of faith, these kind of patriarchs that we think about having this kind of special access to God. God shows up in some form to Abimelech and dialogues with him, which is really kind of an interesting thing. There's also a little bit of a difference in, although in both cases, Abraham comes away with quite a few possessions, a little different form that takes between chapter 12 and chapter 20. Peggy? Yeah. Yeah. The new piece of information we get in chapter 20 is, I mean, we're focusing on chapter 12 and chapter 20 look a lot alike. As Sister Farron has pointed out, apparently there would have been a few other episodes to pick from where this ploy was being acted out, because Abraham does reveal, this is what we do anytime we're traveling. I asked Sarah to do this for me because I'm kind of constantly afraid of what might happen when we're among people that I don't know. So this is apparently something that happened on maybe more than just these two occasions. I don't know if it landed them in the kind of trouble that it did here, but it's apparently their standing practice when they're journeying. Yeah, Ron. Okay, and we'll talk about that more in just a moment. Very interesting the way that these people are dealt with by God, and we'll see that coming up a couple of times in these two chapters, just the idea that we have of God having this special relationship with Abraham, and he does. He's made covenant with him. There is an extra dimension to that relationship, but he is still the God of all people. He isn't one of these local deities of the Philistines or any Canaanite peoples. He is the God of all nations. He is the God of all people, and he deals with them the same way that he deals with so many other people. He will extend mercy. He will expect certain things. He will give them an opportunity to change and to correct their behavior and reward them when they do that. So pay attention to how God deals with Abimelech and his people, and there's even some things said about that that are interesting to us. Anything else there before we start? Yeah, Eva. Yeah. Yeah. Another new wrinkle, and again, one that we'll talk about more in a moment, that does kind of have some bearing, especially in the context, especially at the time that this event takes place. That's an interesting thing for Abraham to say, and it's an interesting thing for him to be proven wrong in, basically, that he, you know, as we're out here traveling among all these other people, I didn't know if there were people who feared God, or the gods, or whatever, you know, conceit they might have had of that. Abraham, from his perspective, is looking at it as, he couldn't say I'm among foreigners. You understand what I mean by that. They're the people who actually live there. He's the foreigner, but I'm among people who don't know Jehovah. You know, I was worried at the morality of those kind of people. David? Okay. A very, you know, you look at chapter 12, and Pharaoh tells everybody, okay, give him his stuff, give him a lot of, you know, possessions. He had already given a lot of stuff to Abraham, I think trying to win his favor as the brother-in-law. But then after everything comes to light, he says, here's your wife, take her and go your way. In much the same way that the Egyptians would do to the Israelites later when they're leaving in the Exodus, get out of here. You know, we're ready to see the back of you. You leave. Here in chapter 20, especially when we get into chapter 21, Abimelech is able to say, stay close by. They enter into a covenant with each other. They end up having an arrangement between each other. So maybe ends on better footing than in chapter 12. So a lot of interesting interplay between these two very similar accounts. One of the other things that we find, I've mentioned the context several times. One aspect of that is what we see in the life of Abraham happening several times, which is highs and lows. Again, very human, very, I know we're talking about things that actually happened, but very realistic, if you understand what I mean by that. It's an honest portrayal of life. Abraham has just had this occasion where he has gone to God on behalf of Sodom and has pleaded for mercy and lenience for those people, and God has answered him, and he has listened to Abraham. God has had this discussion with Abraham as with a friend, and kind of had that bit of bargaining, so to speak. Lot was saved, his beloved relative saved out of the disaster at Sodom only because of Abraham and the respect and love that God had for Abraham, that God remembered Abraham, and that's why he sent Lot out of the midst. So you've got this relative high point where Abraham has been doing well for quite a while. He's been having all of these victories of faith, these spiritual victories, and now he goes back to a point of failure, kind of a low point. And that happens multiple times throughout Abraham's life. It's those valleys and peaks. And so the other outcome of that is, of course, that the promise is once again put in jeopardy. We're so close to Isaac being born. We're so close we can taste it. It's in the next chapter. It's about to finally happen after these decades of waiting. But for this one final time, we're going to have Abraham separated from his wife taken into another man's home. And so these things that God has been telling him, that you and your wife are going to have a child, once again, really kind of for the last time, that promise is imperiled because of Abraham's foolish decision, because of this deceit that they continue to play out. So again, we have mentioned already sort of what is newly revealed here, which is that they had used this strategy, this kind of deceptive ploy, when they had gone on various travels, and still not learning the lesson, I guess, from the times that had backfired. One of the other differences that we notice here, we didn't really mention it as much, maybe a few things related to it, but Abimelech does come off pretty well here. He's honorable. I mean, when the Lord tells him what's going to happen, you know, you're a dead man. You've taken a man's wife, and he says, I didn't know that. If I knew that, I wouldn't have done it. He pleads innocence, and we can really see his case. That idea combined with, you know, what we talked about there verse 11, the fear of God is not in this place, is what Abraham says of the people of Gerar or wherever they might have been in the surrounding environs. Does that take on any added significance based on where we are in the general story to you? What has just happened? What are we? Keep in mind, this isn't originally written in chapters. If you're just reading the story through, what have we just come out of by the time we get to this story in chapter 20? All right, Sodom and Gomorrah, which is a record of people of this general area who don't have the fear of God, the exact opposite of that. They have no respect or regard for God. They live completely contrary to anything that he would find pleasing or righteous, and we see ultimately what their punishment is, but a very grim portrayal of the people of this area that we found in chapter 19. Now in chapter 20, we've got a man, again, you know, foreigner, however we want to say that, a not Hebrew, a man not of Abraham or his God, who is really kind of more honorable than Abraham in this passage, at least, the way they act towards each other. He kind of has the upper hand there. Abraham is worried about the fact, I don't know if they have the fear of God here. Who knows what they might do? There's really not any evidence given for that. Although we can definitely understand his fear about that point based on our new knowledge after chapter 19 about what kind of people there are who inhabit these cities. What just happened to some visitors in Sodom in chapter 19? Two men come into the city, and at night, all the villagers come knocking on the door saying, bring those guys out, you know for what purpose. So maybe we can kind of understand Abraham's fear, but it does also teach this lesson, and one that's reinforced all throughout the Old Testament, which is that it is not a person's nationality that determines who they are, that determines what kind of decisions they're going to make. Throughout the Old Testament, there will in fact be some reminders at points that Israel is behaving like Sodom and Gomorrah, that they turn into those cities. And we will find these few individuals sprinkled throughout the Old Testament who act like true Israel should have, who are Gentiles, who are of the nations. And so just kind of an interesting thing to keep our eyes on, maybe something that has some application, but interesting how well Abimelech comes off on the heels of seeing a Gentile city that's just the total opposite. Gary?
There's an interesting fact there in verse 4.
Yes. Sure. Yeah. And yeah. And it's maybe has some connection to verse 18 too. And we won't get too far into this for a variety of reasons, but in verse 18 it mentions that the Lord had closed up all the wounds of the house of Abimelech. There's some indication or some reference there to a physical problem of some kind that was happening in these households at the time. Maybe that would move over to the men as well. Maybe there's some indication that the men were unable to perform with the women, and that could be something that is in light there in verse 6 where God says, I didn't let you. We don't know what function it was, through what means the Lord prevented him, withheld you from sinning against me. But there was some activity on God's part to keep this from being maybe worse than it could have been, which Brother Garen brings up is another thing we see in chapter 12, that there also wasn't anything that happened between the two parties in that case. You mentioned verse 4, and where I thought you might be going with that was another interesting point. Look at what Abimelech says to God in verse 4. Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Does that phrase sound familiar? Does that call back anything that we've looked at recently? What does Abraham say to God when he's about to start? Yeah, it says essentially, I mean, almost identically the same thing. Will you slay a righteous nation also? Will you slay the righteous with the wicked? Here is Abimelech kind of making the same plea that Abraham did. He's just looking at it from his own perspective, you know, maybe putting the king, you know, speaking for himself as the nation because he is the king. But he's really kind of bringing up the same idea from the same perspective. You, if you are a good, righteous God, if you are a wholesome judge of men, then you wouldn't harm an innocent. That wouldn't be a good and righteous thing for you to do. That was the basis of Abraham saying, we need to check out Sodom first. And here Abimelech is saying, I haven't done anything wrong. Why are you coming after me? So interesting that they follow the same lines. Brother Fisher.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That part unavoidable. I guess another difference that I mentioned there is just the setting. I know in a sense, nowhere Abraham goes is permanent during this phase of his life, because he is wandering everywhere. He is living in the tent. But this is more of a place that they're going as kind of their normal or customary wandering. That trip to Egypt, you'll recall, was because of a famine in the Promised Land. He had to go down there just for a while, just until they were able to go back and inherit the land that God had promised to him. Or was going to promise to him, but this is a little bit more, you know, we're staying here for a while. And this general region, especially Beersheba, about 25 miles away from where they are now, is kind of a base of operations for Abraham and later Isaac. So they'll be here for a little while. I don't know if that makes it maybe even more foolish to try to use the old sister story, to try to use that old trick, you know, we're planning on being here for a while, how long can we keep this going? You know, how long is this going to last? Especially, here's the one that really kind of makes me scratch my head. If this is put chronologically when it happened in the account, and I think it is. I mean, there's no reason to think that it's placed here haphazardly. Sarah should be expecting a child within a few months from Abraham. That's what God told her is going to happen. Again, I don't know where in that process this would happen, but the last time he talked to him, he said, you've got 1 year, and now we've got all this going on. What did Abraham think is going to happen when Sarah has a baby? We're going to have to cop to it at that point. Yeah, okay, she's my wife. You know, babies don't just appear. There's not a stork that drops them off. This is going to have to be explained somehow. So, again, I don't know what the long-term plan is with everything that's going to be happening with them. Just kind of a weird thing to think about. Well, as we've mentioned, this does end up being solved harmlessly, we might say. It does, you know. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and that's what I've mentioned there. You know, Abraham is now we're told he's a prophet. I guess we could have called him a prophet at various points along the line earlier just because of the function that he has. He has kind of spoken for God or acted as a sort of messenger for God before, but here God calls him a prophet. It is kind of a weird solution that we have to this story because the whole thing is pretty much Abraham's fault. I mean, if he doesn't do what he does, then we don't have this whole situation coming up. And as you mentioned, maybe Abimelech could be kind of frustrated by this here. God tells him, Abraham is going to pray on your behalf. He'll intercede for you, and so you'll be able to get out of this. And he might be able to kind of say, he's the reason I'm in this problem in the first place. You know, now he's going to get me out of it. It's kind of like a guy who comes and smashes your window and says, hey, I sell windows. You know, do you need anything? Well, yeah, I do now because you showed up and did that. So, thanks a lot, Prophet Abraham. It's good that you'll intercede for me. It does, though, if we're seeing the meaning of that, it just continues to show us the value that God places on Abraham. Even when he falls, even when he stumbles, as he is doing here, he is still God's man. He is still a prophet of the Lord. He is still one who can intercede on others' behalf, and God will listen to him. He is still the man that God tagged in the first place, all the way back in Genesis chapter 12, that through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And we've seen that happen time and again. Abraham helps Lot out of a jam. That's the only reason Lot survives. Abraham talks to the Lord on behalf of Sodom and says, if we can find 10 righteous men, then you'll spare the city. And the Lord says, okay. Abraham rescues Lot earlier from the people who had captured him. When people are with Abraham, God is with them. That's what he promised him from the beginning. I'll bless those who bless you. I will bless all families of the earth through you. And we're just continuing to see how seriously God takes that and what exactly that means. It will be through Abraham that Abimelech will be able to get out of this, even though it is kind of his fault to begin with. Yes. Yeah, it is. The first time we'll find the word prophet occurring in the scriptures there in verse 7. Of course, in this section, it is the first book in the Bible, so we'd expect a lot of firsts, but it is maybe relatively late to have the first mention of a prophet, you know, 20 chapters in. But, Abraham, there's a trivia question for us, I guess. Who's the first prophet of God clearly identified? It's Abraham. So things end up being settled by peaceful means. Abimelech agrees, I don't want any trouble out of all of this. Ends up sending Sarah back after a little bit of rebuke that he gives Abraham there in verse 9. Verse 9 and 10, just to briefly mention something that we've talked about before, here's just another good example of it. When you find a repetition in a dialogue section, when you find a repetition of one speaker without the other guy speaking in between. So like look at verse 9, Abimelech said to Abraham, you know, what have you done? How have I offended you? You've done deeds to me that ought not to be done. He's really reading in the riot act. In a dialogue, you expect Abraham to then say his part, but he doesn't here. It's the next verse, verse 10, reintroduction of the speech formula. Then Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you have in view that you've done this thing? That pause or that absence where Abraham doesn't say anything is telling, because it's usually showing to us the man that should be speaking in that place is confused or doesn't have anything to say, or there's just something going along that prevents him from speaking in his turn, so to speak. In this case, it's kind of easy to understand why that happens. What can Abraham say? I mean, what defense can he give? He doesn't have a good argument. And when he does start speaking in verse 11, it's going to be this kind of, well, you know, I'm sorry. I thought things would be worse than they were, and this is what we've done before, and he really doesn't have a very good excuse. So just another example of something we've talked about before. In verse 16, I really like what Abimelech says when all of this is being settled. After mentioning, in verse 15, David mentioned this a moment ago, my land is before you, dwell where it pleases you. So they're definitely making up, right? Things are going to be okay between them, and they really will in chapter 21. But after saying that, look at what he mentions in verse 16. Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. This vindicates you before all who are with you and before everybody. It seems that he's saying this is in some way meant to ensure good optics of the situation, that he is making sure everyone knows there's no impropriety that took place. See, I'm paying back to kind of solve my error. But do you see maybe a subtle jab in verse 16? Call Abraham. Your brother. Yeah. That's what you told me he was, at least. It turns out he's actually your husband, which you neglected to mention a few weeks ago. So I can kind of picture Abimelech giving a bit of a wry laugh or something as he says that. I've given to your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Kind of, yeah, that's what I was told, at least. Good on him for sliding one in there. So he'll show up a little bit later in the story. We'll have more to say about him in chapter 21, beginning in verse 22. Let's move on to chapter 21. I don't know that we'll finish this chapter, but we can definitely get into it a bit. Yeah, Steve, before we go on. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Right. No, 100%. Great observation to make. The lives of the faithful are not the lives of the perfect. They're the lives of the people who trust God and who rely on Him. That's what Abraham does throughout his life. I guess here we could say is kind of a weakness in his faith. It seems he's doing this out of fear of what's going to happen to him. Yeah, if you had perfect, unflappable, unfailing trust in God, then maybe you would never be afraid of anything. But we know the reality of life experience is different than that. But Abraham's course of life shows he is a hero of faith because he trusts God. He believes God. He has confidence that the promises of God will come to pass, and that's the only avenue I have to anything good. That's what that means. And that, as you point out, can bring us hope, because if I'm going to be like these men that God approved of, it doesn't require perfection. It doesn't require that I never sin again in my entire life. And if I do, it's all over with and I've ruined the whole thing. This is a record of people who stumble and who fall, but who get up because they trust the Lord. Yeah, very good point to make. All right, well, let's look in chapter 21. Here, I love the way some translations read that. The New King James is kind of ho-hum. The Lord visited Sarah, as he had said. I like the reading there. The Lord singled out Sarah. He is now going to specifically and kind of personally remember her and do for her as he had spoken. And so now we're going to have, at long last, the promised son arriving in the form of Isaac. Think what all has happened in terms of things that might just make us think it might not happen. Between the time where the Lord said, I'm going to revisit you, you're going to have a son, and now, what all has taken place? We've seen some things in the story that kind of put this in jeopardy or that make us think this is such an incredible event. We saw, for one, in chapter 18 and 19, a few whole cities have been destroyed. We've seen a lot of death. We've seen a lot of lives being ended. We saw with Lot's two daughters at the end of that account in chapter 19. Two young women who were so desperate to have children that they resorted to getting their father drunk to have incest with him and produce children that way. You see from that kind of the preciousness, maybe the difficulty through which children come in this setting. We saw it kind of there at the end of chapter 20, the revelation was given to us of some kind of plague that was preventing any children from being born. All the wombs of the house of Abimelech were closed because of what was going on there. And so no children were being born. Again, it's not something that just happens apart from God and is just sort of the basic everyday fact of human existence. It is something that matters when it happens. When a child is born, it has significance. And so even in spite of a lot of death that has gone on, even in spite of a lot of the difficulties and kind of that unique rarity that is given to a child being born, here is the Lord finally remembering Sarah, singling her out to visit her, and conceiving to then bear a son to Abraham in his old age, at the time, the set time of which God had spoken to him in verse 2. So here is God keeping his covenant. Notice in those first couple of verses an emphasis on what God said. It's God visiting Sarah as he had said. The Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. This all happened at the set time of which God had spoken to him. He's keeping his word. He's faithful to his promises. It's what God told Abraham he would do, that he's going to keep his word, that he's going to answer to everything he has said. All these promises and covenants that God has made with Abraham, he's going to keep up his end. From this account, how's Abraham doing in that regard? Because remember, Abraham has made a covenant with God too. He had a part of that agreement. What's his part? What's he going to do when that child is born? Going to have him circumcised. And so he does that. He's faithful to his word in verse 4. When he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. So you're seeing the interplay between those two things. God did as he said. Abraham did as God commanded him. They're both living up to their end of everything that they were supposed to do. We'll probably finish here on verse 7. And this will maybe be a good stopping point, kind of leading into what we see next week. I do think there are maybe some complex emotions that are going on as this child is born. Sarah says in verse 6, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. That's how the New King James renders it. And then in verse 7 goes on to say, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, for I've borne him a son in his old age. It's easy to picture, and obviously I prefer to picture this as being a joyful scene and her speech as being one of happiness that, you know, God has made me laugh and all who hear will laugh with me. That's talking about the happiness that this child will bring. And I'm not discounting that at all. You know, it, no matter how old you are, who reaches an age where they're old enough that they don't like a baby anymore, right? We all love a baby. We all love to see that. I know I'm biased, especially right now, but yeah, Sarah can easily say, God has made me laugh, and she's been waiting so long for this. Can you imagine the overflow of happiness that's taking place here? But that laughter, that laughing, is a word that really still today, of course, has or can have different connotations based on how you're using it. And even in verse 6, when she's saying that, the prepositions maybe aren't exactly clear. If she's saying, God has made me laugh, she could. It would not be butchering the translation to say, God is laughing at me. God is, and we kind of make a play on that sometimes when we say, or we used to say to people in school, if you were kind of making fun of someone, you'd say, we're not laughing with you, we're laughing at you. And, right, that means I'm not laughing because what you did is funny, I'm laughing because what you did is silly or it's dumb. I'm making fun of you and laughing. What we're going to see in verse number 9, we'll get to this more next week, Sarah sees Ishmael, the New King James translates it as scoffing. And what he's doing there is the same word. He's laughing, is what she sees. And she perceives it as a negative thing. We'll have to talk then about what, you know, what he's doing or what that actually means. But it's the same word used in a different way there to mean something bad. He is in some way, you know, having sport, laughing at someone's expense, maybe Isaac's expense or at her expense, but she sees him doing something that is offensive to her, and it seems God really kind of agrees with that assessment in the course of events. So while this could just be the net positive that we like to assume of it, I think it at least opens up the possibility that there is a little bit more of a mix of not bitterness necessarily, but her understanding that people might respond to this with kind of a sneering laugh when they see this 90-something-year-old woman who's just born a child. And when they see these two very old people who are going to be raising a child who could be their grandson, this is something that people might not respond as well to. All who hear will laugh with me. So just, again, food for thought. I still prefer to think this is just her kind of outburst of praise and seeing what a good thing God has brought after all these years. Gary. Okay, that could be. We'll have to talk more about that next week, looking at the chronology of all of this. When are these events taking place after each other? Because there is some discussion to be had over how old is Ishmael when this happens. Is he still a young child who needs to be carried, or is he? We can find references to him maybe being older, being a teenager by this point. We'll look at that more together next week. Other comments, Sherry? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And this, no, good point that Sherry brings up, and we mentioned that, I think, even in chapter 12, when Sarah was probably in her 60s at that point, I guess, and you know, we find she seems to be a beautiful, young, kind of marriageable woman that is being looked at as, well, if no one else has taken her, I'm going to do that, is kind of the idea that Pharaoh has. So what we have mentioned before does still come into play. This is not a 2021 version of 90-year-olds and 100-year-olds having children, not the same. But the way they speak about it does make it sound as though it is still something that's unexpected. It is still people who are old to be in this stage of their life. Not to the extent that we would assign to those numbers, but they are living on a different time clock. Abraham will live to 175, and he's still doing, you know, pretty impressive physical feats into his hundreds and into their old age. They're still living a nomadic lifestyle during this time period. I mean, these are not typically the 90 and 100-year-old people we would think of. So, good point to mention there. Along those lines, though, I'll just mention briefly before we finish, another interesting difference we didn't mention between chapter 12 and chapter 20. In chapter 12, there was an emphasis on Sarah is a beautiful woman, and that's why Pharaoh wants to have her as his wife. I'm not saying she wasn't still beautiful by chapter 20, but that isn't mentioned specifically. He just takes her as wife. We can see many things that would be appealing about her anyway. She appears to be wealthy. Maybe he already liked the look of Abraham, and this guy seems solid. I'd like for him to be a brother-in-law, maybe. Maybe she was still very beautiful, and it's not just mentioned. But we have had nearly 30 years pass by this point, and so while not a just decrepit, ancient person kind of hobbling around, these are people who are in their phase of life where we would think, they're probably not going to be having children, right? That's how Sarah herself seems to think of it, at least. Yeah. 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 It's, something that he didn't expect to see, and something that's going to be, add some complications, maybe. All right. Thank you very much for the comments, the participation, and attention tonight. Always a pleasure to look at these things with you. Because we didn't finish, we'll pick up in about verse 8 next week, chapter 21, and go through the rest of that chapter together next week. I don't know that we'll make it further than that, but look forward to that next Wednesday. Thank you guys so much for your time. I see Dylan back there, and I'll turn the services over to him.